We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. If you have a little more space in your schedule this summer, give Muse a try. It's a great way to start or deepen your meditation practice. And as you'll hear from Dan Harris today, meditation is a darn good tool to have in your life. 10% Happier author and former ABC News anchor Dan Harris joined us in the early days, almost 6 years ago, on Untangle's 7th episode. In this interview, he shared the story of how he came to believe that meditation is, in fact, a way for all of us to be at least 10% happier and a great way to tame the monkey mind, or as he says, get centered again when your wayward thoughts are yanking you around. He's funny and honest and shares how meditation has helped him handle conflict and everyday annoyances with those who matter most in his life. He discusses tools for learning meditation, especially for those who say they can't sit still. He calls them fidgety skeptics. Now, here's an encore edition with Dan Harris. Thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to roll back the clock for a second. Okay. And I want to know who you were when you were 10 years old. Just give us a little context.
Who I was when I was 10 years old. I was fifth grader in Newton, Massachusetts. My parents were physicians. I was really into soccer. I had a little brother who I despised. Probably a troublemaker and a little bit of a bully. And then shortly thereafter, everybody hit puberty and I didn't for a couple of years. So things got a little ugly. I had the mix of being in my head and also being impulsive and unpleasant. So it was like kind of a sort of not a great mix.
Did everybody agree with that, or is that just your opinion?
I think a lot of people would have agreed with it. I mean, I definitely had my friends. I was kind of one of those obnoxious, thought he was cool kids.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had a lot of friends, but I sometimes wasn't so nice.
Were you like master of the universe as a kid kind of thing?
I think it was combined with and fueled by a lot of insecurity.
Okay. Okay.
So I didn't think I was a master of the universe.
But sort of on the outside?
I think I presented as cocky, but was super insecure at the same time.
Yeah.
But also probably had moments of truly being cocky too. It was a mix. I feel like I was a moron until about 6 months ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's long past.
That's
10
a
years
long
old.
Time of being a moron. Yes. I may still be one.
So you
were not a religious kid, not into spirituality, except for your bar mitzvah, which you did just for the money.
Yes.
Okay.
That is in line with everything else I've said about me being as a kid. Yeah, I was not. My parents were very secular. Mm-hmm. But I begged them to send me to Hebrew school because all my friends were getting bar mitzvahs.
Right.
But I didn't. It was not. I wasn't some sort of spiritual itch on my part.
Right. Okay. So you got bar mitzvahed and then sort of forgot about that.
Yeah.
And you
kept the money.
You kept the money. Yeah. Good. Good. Did you save?
Yeah. I don't know what happened to that money. I need to ask my parents what happened to that money. I suspect they spent it.
Oh, drats.
I know.
Okay. So then you go to college and you always want to be a reporter?
No. I mean, I actually had TV reporting and the movies mixed up in my mind in some weird way. I wanted to do something fun and cool. And so I actually went to film school at NYU for a semester when I was in college, which was long enough for me to realize I wasn't very good at that. But the one class I took at film school that I really liked was documentary. And so meanwhile, I was doing a lot of internships in news, and I thought that would be cool and interesting to be on TV. But I don't think I got the journalism bug until I actually started doing the work and realized that I really liked the deeply unglamorous work of gathering information and asking hard questions. Mm.
So when you went to film school, were you wanting to be in front of the camera or behind the camera?
No, I wanted to be a director. I thought that was kind of
cool. That's very cool.
Yes, but I was not good at it.
Well, it's good to learn that early on instead of like making 10 bad movies or something.
Well, I don't think anybody would have let me make a movie. I think it's very useful to learn what you're not good at, especially for a young person.
Oh, okay. To experiment, right?
Be humble. And also by process of elimination, you get to what you are good at and what you really do like.
Yeah.
And then you need to go after that with extreme prejudice, I think.
So you come to New York. There's no meditation in this part of the story, correct?
None. Well, whatever the opposite of that is.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Mindlessness.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The master of mindlessness.
Yeah. Case study in mindlessness.
Okay.
So I was probably, like I'd say, a moron until about 6 years ago.
Okay, good. That's better than 6 months ago.
Yeah. It depends. You know, if you ask my wife, she'd probably say I'm still a moron. But yes, probably about 6 years ago. But much of my life was engulfed in mindlessness. And I would say that probably most lives are, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. So you get discovered while you're in Maine, and how do you get to New York? To ABC. You're working for Peter Jennings.
Yes. I did a year and a half in Bangor, a couple of years in Portland, Maine, then a couple of years in Boston. And then I got a job at ABC News at age 28. And pretty quickly after arriving at ABC, I kind of came into the orbit of Peter Jennings, which was amazing. And he was somebody I had admired, you know, ever since I was aware that there was such a thing as TV news. And he was this really interesting, scary dude, but I learned an enormous amount from him. I mean, he was, in my view, the best TV news journalist probably ever. Mm-hmm. And incredibly inspirational on a thousand levels.
Yeah.
Really contrarian, really smooth, really smart, really tough. Really creative, curious.
So you are this young kid and you're given all this responsibility. And then after 9/11, you're sent to Iraq and Afghanistan and Israel.
Yeah.
And this is a really difficult time.
I mean, that was actually a thrilling time. You know, the fact of the matter is I was having a good time. I felt like it was really important work. But it was also really very thrilling to be in places you're not supposed to be and getting on television and being really right in the thick of the action and surviving. Not everybody I knew did.
Right.
And I think there was an enormous amount of idealism mixed with immaturity and a complete and sort of utterly mindless lack of sense of what the consequences could be psychologically. So then after doing a couple of years of this, I came home in the summer of 2003. And at that point, it became a difficult experience because I started to get depressed.
Right. Did you know you were depressed?
No.
What did it feel like? Like,
I was having trouble getting out of bed. Mm. I felt like I had a low-grade fever all the time.
Did you still feel excited about going into work every day? Because here was your dream career.
I did. Because I was being home. The world seemed kind of gray and boring.
Right. Okay.
As opposed to when I was overseas.
Yeah.
And so even though my work here was exciting, I think again, I wasn't really entirely cognizant of this because, to restate what I think is probably thunderously obvious to anybody listening at this point, I wasn't super introspective. Mm. I mean, that may be giving myself short shrift. I think I wasn't a complete idiot. I was introspective in some ways, but I certainly didn't have the wherewithal to the self-awareness to connect my physiological symptoms to some sort of psychological.
And did you have people around you that were noticing that you were a little bit different and kind of worrying about you?
I think my parents worried about me from a distance. Mm-hmm. And they had said things like, you know, maybe that there was going to be some sort of psychological consequences to going overseas. And I cavalierly brushed it off. Mm-hmm. So I think I was, clearly took some native intelligence in order to get where I had gone. But I didn't want to think about the fact that the stuff that I was doing that was clearly good for my career and was clearly exciting to me might somehow not redound to my benefit.
Right. That could be crushing.
Yes.
So how'd you get out of the depression?
Well, I did what any smart person does. I started using cocaine and ecstasy. And I didn't start doing it actually consciously to get out of the depression. I was in a big, long, several-month period where I didn't feel well.
Yeah.
And I never used hard drugs. And a friend of mine one night offered me some cocaine, and I was just feeling like shit. So I did it. And I obviously all of a sudden
feels
great.
Good.
Yes. And I didn't know it at the time. But, you know, what I think happened to me in the war zones was not PTSD, but an addiction to adrenaline. Mm-hmm. And what does cocaine do? It's a synthetic squirt of adrenaline. Yeah. And so this was a way for me to sort of feel the way I felt in the war zones. Again, I didn't connect any of these dots until much later with the help of a shrink.
So you keep doing this, and I think there's a line in your book that a friend says to you, Dan, you have the soul of a junkie. You know, you talk also about having an addictive personality, yep. And I think that's similar, right?
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It's the same. It's a way of saying the same thing.
So in a way,
yeah,
the panic attack that comes next was a gift.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yes, for sure.
Bow to the panic attack.
Yeah. There are consequences that I still have to live with that are unpleasant. But yes, because I think if I hadn't had a panic attack, I would have kept doing drugs for a while. Mm-hmm. I might still be doing drugs. And I think if I had kept doing drugs, I probably wouldn't have met the woman who I now married, with whom I now have a son. And, you know, so I think there would have been knock-on consequences that would have been bad.
Yeah. But instead, what happened?
Yeah, in 2004 on the air in Good Morning America, I had a panic attack. I just was unable to breathe. And I had to quit. And I was reading the news headlines. It's the person who comes on at the top of each hour in the morning shows and does the sort of quick rundown of the day's headlines. And I just lost it in the middle. If you look at it's on YouTube. If you look at a lot of people say, oh, it didn't look that bad. I think it looks like I can't breathe. I stumble a little bit and then I just stop and throw it back to the main hosts of the show. Well, that was that's the key point, which is that I had this, that was a real gift. In that moment, I didn't have to keep going because there were the hosts of the show, Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer, sitting right there. So I just kind of said back to you guys and they took it over. But if they weren't there, I would have ripped the mic off and run away.
But it seemed like you had the presence to throw back to them.
Yeah. I mean, you have to bear in mind, I had been doing this work for a good solid 10 years and basically grew up on camera. So I was able to draw upon reserves of at least external. I was able to hold it together at least externally in some ways I think probably other people might not have been able to because this is something I know how to do. But I definitely lost it. There's no question it was a full-on panic attack.
Right.
And again, I didn't connect it to the drugs at all until I had a second panic attack a year later. And then I went to a doctor who asked me, do you do drugs? And I said, yes. And he said, okay.
Game over.
Mystery solved.
Right. So you have the panic attack. You start seeing a doctor, therapist, psychologist.
Psychiatrist.
Yeah. And at the same time, you're out talking to evangelists and different self-help leaders.
Yes. So it's the chronology is a little weird, so I won't get too deeply into it, but so I had the panic attack. That wasn't enough to kind of get me into meditation. Something else had to happen, which was Peter Jennings assigned me to cover faith and spirituality, which I didn't want to do. And I tried to get out of, in fact. And then he didn't care. He said, you're going to do it anyway. Which ended up being a good thing for me. I then spent many years in mosques and megachurches, Mormon temples, et cetera, et cetera, and met a lot of really interesting people and realized how ignorant I was about this issue, about faith and spirituality, religion. And it was a really interesting period of time for me. That being said, none of what I found spoke to me personally. I didn't go kosher or join a church or anything like that until 2008. So many years after being assigned this beat and many years after the panic attack, when I read a book by Eckhart Tolle. And that was really the moment that put me on the path toward meditation.
That is so interesting to me because a few people have mentioned that. And I remember when I first read his book, I could not get into it at all. And I think you said something similarly, that, and then you went back to read it afterwards, or what was your experience with him and with the book?
Yeah, well, so when I first read the book, I hated it. I thought it was complete bullshit. I was reading it not because I had some deep spiritual yearning. I was reading it because a producer with whom I worked thought that Eckhart Tolle might be a good story. So I was sort of reading it a little bit out of obligation or professional curiosity, not personal curiosity. So I powered through the point by which, if I was reading it as a civilian, I would have thrown it out the window.
Right. Okay.
Because it had the, in my view, like mixed, what's the opposite of blessings? Mixed, like curses of being turgid and boring and pseudoscientific and grandiose,
sort of, and ethereal. He's sort of up there.
And I wouldn't mind if so much if he was up there and cogent, but it's up there and like crazy in some areas.
Yeah.
That being said, two things. One, when I read it now, it seems a lot less crazy knowing what I know, having it explained to me in English.
Right, right.
And I don't think he's crazy now. Also, in his defense, he is incredibly lucid at and skilled at explaining the voice in the head, this inner narrator that we all have. And reading that changed my life, for sure. And as much as I like to make fun of Eckhart Tolle, I cannot deny the fact that he changed my life. Yeah, he's also, you know, you can get turned off by lots of things. The elliptical nature of his logic at times, his just presentation for somebody like me is really hard to deal with. I mean, he's an elfin German man who speaks, you know, as if he's been shot up with like a several pounds worth of Valium. And he's a strange man, I think, by a lot of common measures. But when you read the best parts of his books where he talks about our ego, or the thinking mind, it's incredibly powerful. You know, his argument is that we have this inner narrator that chases us out of bed in the morning and is yammering at us all day long and has us constantly wanting stuff, not wanting stuff, judging ourselves, comparing ourselves to other people, judging other people, thinking about the past or thinking about the future to the detriment of whatever's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And when you're unaware of this, it yanks you around, you know, and it's why we eat when we're not hungry, or lose our temper when it's not strategically wise, or we're checking our email in the middle of a conversation with our kid. And for me, this was the moment where it came full circle, because I realized the voice in the head is why I went to war zones without thinking about the consequences, came home, got depressed, was insufficiently self-aware to know it, and then blindly self-medicated with recreational drugs. So it was A, intuitively true, and B, really explained the most embarrassing moment of my life. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of set my hair on fire a little bit.
It's almost like you were on automatic pilot for many, many years.
Yeah, my whole life.
Your whole life. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I think most of us live
right in that space.
Yeah, I think most of us live that way. I mean, not all the time, and not all of us, but for me at least, much of the time, much of my life.
Well, I feel like what I love about what you're doing is you're translating a lot of this language for people, which I think is so important. And even, you know, I love this line that you also had in the book when you were talking about Deepak, and he said something about the transformational vortex. And I loved your reaction to that. And I sort like, what does that mean?
I was asking about staying in the present moment.
Okay.
And how does he stay in the present moment? And he was saying that he basically was arguing that he is perennially present. And then he was waxing poetic about the power of the present moment. And he went on to call it the transformational vortex to the infinite.
And that was after, I think, were you saying, like, what if you really have to go to the bathroom?
Yeah, what if you pee or you're really hungry or whatever?
And he was like, and you're like, so do you know what that meant?
I think now? What he's saying is that when you are fully right here, right now, you are connected to the infinity of the universe.
Okay.
That it is right now everywhere in this infinite universe. And it always is right now. And we spend so much of our time, you know, projecting the future or ruminating about the past,
yeah,
blinded to the power of whatever's happening right now. And so I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could translate it.
Yeah.
But it's like hard to think of a more annoying way to put it.
So this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health. Mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, over to Untangle.
Eckhart was a huge sort of pivotal point for you. You interviewed Deepak, you've interviewed the Dalai Lama, and then this other great teacher came into your life, Mark Epstein.
Yeah.
Was he the other...
What happened was I read Eckhart Tolle, then I spent a lot of time kind of hanging around in the self-help world.
Yeah.
I met Deepak and a bunch of other self-help guys. Deepak is on the far benign end of the spectrum. Deepak is a very charming guy, and very smart, and I think it's helped a lot of people. I like to make fun of him too, but I don't think he's, there are people in the self-help world that are clearly not a force for good in the universe, peddling all this kind of snake oil. So I spent a lot of time in that world, and then I was kind of at wit's end, and then I came home one night from work, and my then fiance and now baby mama, Bianca, gave me a book by Dr. Mark Epstein as a gift, surprise. She said, I've been hearing you talk about Chopra and Tolle and the voice in the head, with varying levels of cogency, and made me think. It made me remember this book that you might like. And so when I read that book, that was another aha moment for me, because I realized that the stuff that I liked most about Tolle appeared to have been lifted largely without attribution from somebody called the Buddha. And so finding Buddhism was a huge moment for me, because the Buddha talked about the voice in the head too. Mm-hmm. He called it the monkey mind.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Eckhart Tolle, he had a very simple, actionable piece of advice for dealing with the voice in the head, which was meditation.
Right.
Which brought a fresh problem up, which is that I didn't want to meditate.
Because
I thought it was for hippies and weirdos. And
so meditation. So you're like, okay, there's a path that seems reasonable.
I was intrigued by the clarity of the Buddha's voice on this and by the fact that Dr. Mark Epstein is a doctor and a normal human being who I then met and had beers with, and he didn't claim to be perennially in the present moment. There was no grandiose language about transformational vortices to the infinite. He was just a really normal guy.
Yeah.
So I was very impressed by him, and that he was really interested in the Buddha made me interested in the Buddha too, but I wasn't going to meditate until I started doing further sort of poking around, and I found out that there's a lot of science that shows that it's good for you. That is what changed my mind. Let me just say too, it was the science that shows, and I want to say that the science is sometimes in danger of being overhyped, but it strongly suggests a long list of health benefits. Mm-hmm. And then I learned that the meditation doesn't involve, wearing robes or sitting in a funny position or joining a group or believing in anything per se, that that's really simple and that it's been thoroughly secularized, and that anybody can do it. And you don't have to clear your mind or stop thinking or anything like that. It's just about focusing the mind for nanoseconds at a time, getting lost, starting over, getting lost, starting over, getting lost, starting over. And then that really, learning all of that allowed me to start.
So for you, how cool that you got to do all this as part of your, the again, faith and spirituality beat, because you're still doing it for ABC, right? You're still talking to all these people for ABC, but at the same time, you're like, oh, this could be useful for me.
Well, I was basically just co-opting my employer's resources to to pursue my own personal ends. So, and I'm still doing it.
Yeah, that worked out nicely for you.
Yeah, it actually works out nicely for ABC. They're fine with it as long as it makes good television.
Right. So how did you actually start learning to meditate?
I just read a couple books.
Oh, okay. Which books were those that taught you to meditate?
The one that really started me was Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn.
Oh, yeah.
And that has very simple instructions in it. But I was kind of interested in Buddhism, so I wanted to go that route. And so after a couple of weeks, I switched to Buddhist meditation and secularized Buddhist meditation, which is what Jon Kabat-Zinn does, which is sort of mindfulness-based stress reduction. And it's so simple, you can do it if you just read a book. I think when I look back at it now, and I say this in part as somebody who's started a company that does guided meditations on it via an app, when I look back at it now, I honestly believe if I hadn't been so snooty about guided meditations, my practice would have progressed more easily.
Because
it's nice to have the guidance.
Yeah, I think it's nice to do both.
You don't want to learn too many styles, I think, because you can get confused very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Doubt, especially for somebody like me, doubt comes up a lot. Doubt about, am I doing this right? And so I think this having some structure, at least for me, has been very useful.
So you learned mindfulness-based stress reduction. Did you go to the retreat first, or did you do that after you started meditating and felt like you were a pretty confident meditator?
I was not a confident meditator. Okay. I did it for a year, and then I went on a retreat.
So can you just tell us a little bit about a retreat for people that might want to try doing a silent retreat?
Yeah. I think it's a great idea. I mean, I highly recommend it. I don't think you, in many places, I'm very careful to point out to people that you don't have to do this. You can meditate without going on retreat. It's not a must if you can't afford it or if you can't get the time. But I think it really makes a big difference. And you're entering into a really specialized container where you are doing nothing but meditating, and you're going to get better at it. It will suck uncontrollably. It's really hard.
Did it suck the whole time, or it stopped sucking on the fourth day?
Yeah, it stopped sucking on the fourth day.
Seems to be common. Have you talked to other people?
Yes. Fourth, fifth day, people say it stopped sucking.
And then it starts sucking a little bit again towards the end.
Yeah, no, it sucks pretty hard again. This is one of the central lessons of Buddhist meditation, which is nothing lasts. And so you will hit periods of real bliss, but then it'll go away.
Mm-hmm.
And the struggle, the suffering comes from, you know, clinging to it.
Right.
And even in the first 4 or 5 days when things are really bad, the game is just to notice your aversion to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how you learn to really apply the basic lessons of mindfulness meditation, which, one of which is you don't have to feel any certain way. You just have to feel whatever you're feeling clearly so that you don't get carried away by it. And you really learn that on retreat because you're thinking all the time, how do I get the f*** out of here?
Right.
And this sucks. And when is it over?
Yep.
And, you know, who are these weird people? And
where's
blah, blah, blah.
Escape route.
Yes. But then you just notice impatience, judging, doubt, restlessness. And all of a sudden, in the moment of noticing that, these stories that are taking up the full frame of your experience can be seen with some perspective.
Mm-hmm.
They're objectified, as it were. And that's the game,
mm-hmm.
because that has such profound implications for the way you live your life where we're just bombarded by urges and impulses and desires, and we we just are led around by the nose.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be in this place where everything's taken care of for you, your meals, your they keep the power running, they've got a schedule for you, your phone's taken away or turned off and put in a drawer or whatever, and all you have to do is really confront what's happening in your head, you get a very big dose of like your actual life. Yeah. And can be a very powerful way to practice.
Yeah. It seems like meditation has been an entry point for a lot of other learnings beyond that. So are you now like interested in Buddhist philosophy or as it relates mostly to mindfulness-based stress reduction?
Oh, I'm a Buddhist.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that part.
So I don't have any problem calling myself a Buddhist because I think it means more and less than most people think.
Right.
Less in the sense that it's not a religion,
yeah.
At least not the way I practice it. It can be practiced as a religion.
Yeah.
Millions of people do in Asia. But at its core, you know, the Buddha said, I have a few metaphysical theories, but take them or leave them. You don't have to believe in karma or enlightenment or
nirvana.
Any of it.
Yep.
It's just about seeing what you experience in your own mind, in the laboratory of your own mind. And so calling myself a Buddhist doesn't mean I'm part of a religion. It just means that I practice Buddhism. Stephen Batchelor, who I know you've spoken with, has a great expression, which is Buddhism is not something to believe in. It's something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I'm very much a Buddhist.
Yeah,
I love that. And that way, it also means more than just having a set of beliefs or going to church on one day. It's actually something that should infuse every moment of your life.
Yeah, taking it off the pillow.
Correct. Yes. That's... I don't always do that, but.
But you know,
it's my aspiration.
It's my aspiration,
yes.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Do you think that we're heading in a direction where more and more people will meditate and learn different types of mm-hmm. meditation and sort of integrate it into their families and their workplaces and schools?
I hope we are.
Yeah.
I think we are.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, my powers of prognostication aren't awesome, but all the signs point mm-hmm. to it. Meditation is just being adopted in so many disparate and fascinating and areas of the culture, from business to entertainment to the military, sports, broadcast news. I think we're at a key juncture. We need it to be offered up with integrity
mm-hmm.
And authenticity and with some variety to suit different needs.
So I just want to cover a few more things mm-hmm. about, you know, so you've had this major transformation in your life as a result of meditation and this whole sort of path that you've been on for the last several years. What advice would you give to people in general if they want to get started in meditation? And how patient would you ask them to be in terms of finding some of the results that you've found?
I would say, first of all, it doesn't need to be some big stressful thing you add to your to-do list. I think 5 to 10 minutes a day is enough. No matter how busy you are, and I'm very busy, you have 5 to 10 minutes a day. I don't think this is a big stretch.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. And then I would say, second thing I would say is that something that I found useful is to employ a kind of accordion approach, which is, on days where it's super crazy, just do something, even if it's 60 to 90 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a real power to the dailiness. If you do it every day, it's that kind of daily collision with the asshole in your head that allows you to fend off its shitty suggestions, which is basically its job. And so the daily seeing of our internal insanity allows you to have a fighting chance not to eat the 18th cookie or to say the thing that's going to ruin the next 48 mm-hmm. hours of your marriage. And if you just do something every day, you're less likely to start telling yourself the story of I'm a failed meditator.
Mm.
You're less likely to fall off
right.
the wagon
yeah.
and then go into this rut of like, I can't do this. I don't have time, blah, blah, blah. So do it every day. Do a short amount every day. And on crazy bad days, just do a couple seconds or a minute or whatever. And then the third thing I'd say is, in terms of how patient you need to be, Tell yourself you're going to do it for 4 to 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Just try it.
Yeah, I've started to see the benefits pretty, you know, within a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. It often will be other people in your life who will see it before you. Mm. I remember overhearing my wife at parties saying, yo, he's less of an a-hole. And I don't think you're going to see miracles right. as a consequence. I think you're just going to be – your life will be infused with a greater degree of calm. You'll find that the daily exercise of getting lost and starting over, helps you be more focused and on task, and you're in less prone to multitasking, mm-hmm. which is a neurological impossibility. And then the biggie is that you may find yourself becoming more mindful, which is that you're less yanked around by your emotions. Mm-hmm. And that's huge, huge. I think the final piece of advice I'd say is don't fall for this fallacy that you need to clear your mind. It is impossible to do unless you're a really advanced meditator or you're dead. It's just not going to happen. Every 8-year-old tries to stop thinking and realizes you can't do it. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing in meditation is actually focusing the mind for a few seconds at a time, maybe even a half second at a time, less than that, getting lost, noticing that you've become lost, and starting over. And every time you notice you become lost, you realize it's a very powerful moment. Instead of using it as an excuse for self-flagellation, which I do still, try to see it as a victory, reframe it as a victory, which is you're seeing clearly, oh, this is just these are just thoughts. They're just these little completely immaterial bursts of energy in the mind that don't necessarily have any relationship to reality. And that's a really big deal, because then when you have a stupid thought later, you might not act on it.
Right. So you're not your thoughts.
Yes.
And you're putting some space between your thoughts and your reaction to your thoughts.
Yes. You're learning how to respond wisely mm-hmm. instead of reacting blindly. And that's the game.
Yep.
That's the whole game.
So I love that you're continuing to try and have an impact on people, and you're doing that with your app.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about – I love this app. It's great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We're just starting. It's called – we started an app called 10% Happier. Right. And basically, it's what we're moving to is a subscription service, and you will have access to these classes we're doing with some of the best teachers alive, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and Mark Epstein is going to do a class for us at some point. So you can use the app for free for a while and frankly leave us having learned how to meditate mm-hmm. before you have to pay anything. But if you really like what we're doing, you can sign up and get unlimited access to a ton of content from really great teachers. And the other thing we do that is, I think, really cool. Well, two other things. One is that we have a bit of a sense of humor, and we don't take ourselves super seriously. We take the practice seriously, but not ourselves seriously. And then the other thing is that we give you a coach. The big problem for beginning meditators is they have a lot of questions. And in fact, I think that the questions are all a permutations of one question, which is, am I doing this right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so we have somebody you can text or email with anytime, a real human being who will answer your questions.
But I think the idea of having a coach is really amazing. Weird. It's like having a teacher and being able to ask them questions. And so maybe the next step after having a coach is finding a teacher.
Yeah. So we're trying to crack that exact nut.
Yeah.
I think you don't have to stop at an app. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of people will, because a lot of people don't have the time or energy to really go find a teacher. But I think it's great if you can.
How can they find it?
In the App Store.
Okay.
10% Happier Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics. You know, just put 10% in, you'll find it. For Android users who want to get it, you can go to 10percenthappier.com and you can get a version that will work for your Android.
Oh, cool. So Fidgety Skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
Love that.
Yes. The idea is to most people are fidgety skeptics when it comes to meditation. And so we want to cater pretty aggressively to people like
just
that.
Just put it out there so people know that they're welcome as a fidgety skeptic.
Correct.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I know you woke up at 4 a.m. this morning, mm-hmm. which you do quite often.
I will tomorrow too.
Ooh.
Yes.
So
still doing GMA despite the panic attack.
Yay. That's awesome for the rest of us, for your audience.
I hope so.
Do you wake up with the baby at 4 a.m.? Or is the baby on your schedule?
He's not. We often go to bed at the same time. Sometimes he wakes up when I wake up, but I can't. I got to go.
You got to go.
Yes.
Sorry.
Sometimes I'll give him a little kiss. He's awesome.
Yeah. He looks adorable.
He's really cute, but he's a troublemaker.
Oh, well, like his papa.
Yeah. He has that look in his eye that
oh,
makes me
no.
think. Yes.
Well, thank you so much for making it, and I really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us for Dan's Encore Edition. As always, check out choosemuse.com to learn more about how the headband can support your personal health and well-being. We'd love to hear from you. Who would you like to have on our show? What topics do you enjoy? What do you need or want to learn about right now? Email me at untangle@choosemuse.com. And if you have a minute, please give us a review. It helps a lot. And it always helps to share the love. Hope you have a great week, and we will see you next time.